So welcome to the True Commission, December 7, 2023. We'll start off with introduction, Mr. Carter.
Tommy Carter, Council Auditor's Office.
Daniel Henry, True Commission.
Charles Barr with the Council President.
Raymond Day, Southeast CPAC.
Thelma Roundsville, Northwest CPAC.
And we have, three excused, Kim Pryor, Bruce Tyson, and the chairman, Keshawn Chambliss, and Sir Carter Jones has resigned.
And we have the
opening there.
Carter Jones resigned back as of today.
Yeah. So welcome guest speakers.
Wait, who is the new person?
Carter Jones.
Oh, got it. I'm sorry.
Yep, Carter Jones. Deputy Counsel Lasikia.
Hey,
thank you for coming today. I guess you're going to talk to us about the procurement code rewrite.
I am.
What is your name?
Michael Fackler.
Fackler.
Thank you. I appreciate your. Tuesday is the big vote. I will take it in anticipation. I appreciate your work on this commission, and you, like so many of the commissions and boards throughout the city, look to us for legal advice. And so I am trying to get around and make sure that I meet you, see what you do, make sure that our office is responsive to your needs, that we understand fully what you do and how we can work together collaboratively and make your jobs as easy as possible. So my role here today is simple as an introduction. I'm going to stay for a little while to watch the procedures and learn how you do. But now also you have a face to go with the name, and if you need to have an issue and Lasikia is unavailable, there will be someone else that you know that you can call in the general counsel's office. Hopefully, there will be an after Tuesday.
A mere formality.
So thank you for that. Lasikia Hodges, Office of General Counsel. Just briefly, just a little bit about myself. I have been privileged to work in the Office of General Counsel for 16 years now. It doesn't seem like it's been that long, but it has been that long. I am board certified in city, county, and local government law. I'm the deputy general counsel of our government operations. And so just a brief overview of the Office of General Counsel, because sometimes I think boards and even our clients don't understand sort of the way that our office is organized and really the breadth of all of the things that we do. So we're headed by our general counsel, Michael Fackler, and we have five departments in our office. Two of the departments are really litigation departments, so that's commercial litigation, it's tort, employment law. We have a regulatory department. We have our legislative affairs department. You're used to seeing Jeff, of course, provides lots of assistance to our city council. And then finally, we have our government operations department, which is exactly what the name entails, government operations. And so within our government operations department, there are six transactional lawyers. And part of the reason why I'm here today is to clarify some of the things that were stated at the last meeting when you were talking about 2023-20. And so the first clarification starts with government operations and the fact that there are actually six transactional attorneys in government operations, not just three. I think it was stated on the record inadvertently by our procurement chief that there were three attorneys. And then we have other transactional attorneys that are actually deployed at other independent agencies. Still all OGC attorneys, but transactional attorneys working in-house for example, JEA, the Duval County School Board. So we handle all of the transactional work for the city. So that's minus all of your litigation, the lawyers in government operations, including myself. We draft legislation for the city council. We handle the contracts that you were talking about, that we're talking about in Ordinance 2023-20, the procurement contracts. But I want you to understand that there's a wide range of contracts. As you would know, Mr. Henry, you also have public service grant contracts. We have housing contracts. We have incentive agreements, redevelopment agreements. So there's a wide range of contracts that the six lawyers that I described are working on. The procurement contracts are a sliver of that, a good amount. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about more kind of operationally, just to hit on some of the points that I feel like need to be clarified, and then I'm happy to go through the ordinance that you were talking about. I was the attorney that worked very closely with Councilman McCumber when this bill was filed. So I think at the last meeting, it was more or less stated that I was commenting on it. I was the drafter of the bill and remained the drafter of the bill through the time that the bill passed about a month ago. But just so that you know, from a pure contracting standpoint, I think it was stated that the procurement division does not do contracts. So what they do, they implement the procedures for us to be able to award and enter into the contracts. But the contract administration, as was stated at the last meeting, is done outside of our procurement division. And so all of the development of the RFP, that back and forth, the agency working with procurement, that's handled. Usually, Office of General Counsel is not involved in that. We can be. We are on an as-needed basis. But it's not standard that you would have an attorney that's doing that back and forth because most of those documents are template-driven. I think as some of you or somebody might have notated at the last meeting, there are templates depending on the procurement method that you're using. So your invitation to bid, your request for proposal, those are all going to be contract template driven. And so by the time the award is in place and it gets to the Office of General Counsel, we are not reinventing those terms. In fact, we can't, because that's a part of procurement. When you put a bid out on the street and that procurement solicitation document contains certain general terms and conditions, we can't just negotiate those away. So depending on the type of procurement method, that will determine the level of negotiations that the agency is able to do. So if we're talking about design build, that's a level of negotiation. If we're talking about request for proposal, there's some negotiation that's done there, but not a lot that's going to veer from those basic parameters that's in that request for proposal. And certainly if we're talking about an invitation to bid, which is the most specific type of procurement method where we know what we want and we're putting that out on the street, there's no room for negotiation at all. It's just the lowest bidder. So if we were just taking the contracts that are related to invitation to bids, that's a two-page document. And that two-pager is simply incorporating the terms of the RFP. And so I had my staff, after hearing the conversation at the last meeting, because it's, sometimes I think there's a bit of a misconception, if I'm being frank, about the amount of time that it takes for contracts to move through the Office of General Counsel. So disclaimer, I wasn't able to go back 12 months, but I took a sampling of the month of June. So this is one snapshot month in time of only just our procurement contracts. So I'm not talking about redevelopment agreements because those are outside of procurement. They're all, you know, approved by city council or, for example, our DIA, Downtown Investment Authority, would have the ability to execute those contracts. But if we just took the pure invitation to bid, request for proposals, amendments to those procurement contracts to increase maximum indebtedness, to increase terms, those simplistic contracts, in any given month, so I'm taking the month of June, we have about 40 contracts that's running through. So this would primarily be coming from agencies like the fire department, JSO, Public Works would be a big using agency. There are four stages, if you will, of the contract execution process. So bear with me as I walk you through this. So we have an award. Okay, so we need that. That's document number one that we need. So once we have that award, assuming we have an agency that's prompt, they will then submit a legal request to our office. And so we get the legal request. The legal request is assigned to one of those six attorneys. Primarily two of the six are handling what I would consider very simple, straightforward contracts, right? The invitation to bids, request for proposals, because again, Office of General Counsel isn't negotiating by the time that legal request comes to us. All that negotiation has already been done by the agency. And so the first, you know, stage would be we get that legal request. The second, you know, it's assigned to an attorney. The attorney would then do the legal work and draft that contract. We send it out to the client for the client to have executed by the third party. Because Office of General Counsel isn't dealing with vendors, okay? Our client on these types of contracts, I'm not talking about redevelopment agreements that are more complicated. I'm talking about straightforward procurement contracts. Office of General Counsel, we would send that contract draft to the agency, and they would then send it to the vendor for signature. Once the agency got that contract back from the vendor for signature, then Office of General Counsel would then have possession of it again, and we would run it through our signature process, okay? So the time that it takes, so I've taken one sampling of the month of June, 40 contracts. The average time for the, and I'm taking the main two lawyers that are working on these contracts, for the month of June, the average time that it took this particular lawyer to do 22 contracts was 8 days. And when I say that, I'm talking this is the drafting time. So out of 22 contracts, that's an 8-day turnaround from the time we get the legal request, from the time we send that final draft to the agency so that the agency can go get the contract. And the reason why that amount is so high actually is because we had some outliers. There were a few of these where it took about 42, 44 days. And so when I see that at my level, management level, I immediately know, okay, that was something's going on. That's not a normal contract. That's, there's some back and forth. But for most of the contracts that I'm seeing, the turnaround time is actually 3 days. And if I took those two outliers out, it brings down that average to 4 days that is taking OGC to draft that contract and give it to the agency. So then once the agency gets that signature and gives it back to OGC, okay, that time frame is taking 2 weeks. So that's the client. That's in the client's control. That's not in the Office of General Counsel's control. And it may not be the client. It could be the vendor, or it could be the client. But it's not the Office of General Counsel. That's the point. And then once we get the signed contract back from the client, what I'm finding is that the average time frame to have it executed. So when I say executed, I mean it's going to city finance, then it's going to the mayor's office, then it's coming back to the city to be attested. That average time is 10 days, okay? So the total time on average is 31 days. So that's like 4 weeks total from the time I get a legal request to the time that the contract is executed. But you see how you can break that time up into the attorney's drafting time, the time it takes to get the signature from the vendor, and then the time that it takes from the Office of General Counsel to run it through our signature process to get a completely executed contract. So, you know, from my vantage point, that's not bad at all. And with the two lawyers dedicated full time to do the simple contracts, we could certainly get that time frame down lower if we had more bodies, okay? The other attorney's numbers were the same. The average time was 8.7. So you see that there's consistency with OGC. 8.7 to do the drafting. There was one outlier, 81 days. When I see that, I know there's something going on. This is not a normal contract. So either it had to go back through procurement. There is some negotiation element, but it's not normal to take 81 days for an attorney to draft. But the other contracts I'm seeing out of a 14 contract spread is 2 days, is 3 days. So if I were to take that outlier out, this attorney's average is down to 3.4, okay? But what's consistent is the time it takes to get that executed contract back from the client, 13.3, so that's 2 weeks. So it's taking the client and the vendor, for whatever reason, 2 weeks to return it back to OGC to get it executed. And then once OGC gets that executed contract and sends it off to finance, the mayor's office, and back to OGC, that average for this particular attorney is 4.9 days. So it's a little bit faster, you know, with that attorney, but still the total time. I mean, we typically tell our agencies for planning purposes, for the execution piece of the contract, original vendor, run through the mayor's office, that, you know, you need to plan at least 10 business days. And these are all business days, by the way, that I'm talking about when I give you these numbers. So, you know, that's a sampling. I have my staff actually going back 6 months to pull data from FY23. Going into FY24, we'll begin to track this information. It's my understanding, too, that the ITD department, our information technology department, is actually working on a more automated system, because who wants to be inputting data manually? So having a software program, some of the stuff that Mr. Freeman was talking about at the last meeting, I think that's going to help. Moving to a DocuSign program, no question. The 10 days that I was talking about for the execution, we'll cut that down to 2 to 3 days. We actually have an agency, Kids Hope Alliance, that's using DocuSign within 2 days. It's going through OGC, finance, mayor's office, back to OGC for attestation, like 2 days. So I definitely expect to, you know, see some gains there. But, you know, the overall takeaway, I mean, this is a snapshot, but this is consistent. So I think the message that Michael and I wanted to bring to you today is, yeah, with the government this large, could we use more transactional lawyers? No question. Absolutely. Are we able to do the work we believe in a timely fashion for the simplistic bulk of the contracts that I'm talking about, invitations to bid, requests for proposals? As you stated, Tony, I think at the last meeting, we aren't reinventing the wheel. There are already templates in place. We're not taking a legal request and drafting from scratch. We already have these templates in place, and that's why I think you have these timeframes, you know, that you see. But, you know, can we do better? Can we get that number down? Sure, we can. If I had two more contract lawyers, that number could be one turnaround. It could be 2 days. Do you have any? Are you?
I want you to finish.
Okay. Okay. So that's a point that, you know, I just wanted to sort of correct sort of the time frames. And then if you like, but this would be a good time to sort of break for questions relative to the process, I can then, you know, give you an overview of the substance of the procurement overhaul bill that I'm very excited about. Having worked in procurement for the entire time that I've been here at the city, this rewrite and overhaul is well overdue from bringing us into current times, making it more efficient. And as I told the council president Salem graciously allowed me to present to the council committees, three committees in a row, basically do PowerPoint presentations. And as I told the council, this is a type of bill where you're not going to see those efficiencies and returns year one. What this bill is doing is setting up the framework in order for us to be able to reap the benefits and see that in future years to come. It's not something that's going to be automatic. These are more foundational changes. And I see this as a phase one, and the phase two part of this is no question critical. It's that implementation phase that Dustin was talking about, developing that procurement manual. And that's going to be critical to the success of this bill, because I think all of you probably know you can have the best ideas in the world, but if that implementation isn't the way that it should be, then it's really kind of all for naught. But what I want you to know is that our office will be hand-in-hand working with Mr. Freeman to make sure that operating manual is the way that it needs to be, the IG's office, as well as the city council auditors. I know there have been discussions about bringing in some input from the very vendors that we do business with. That's an idea. But that's going to be a process, and I actually look forward to working with the procurement chief on that. So if it's okay, Chair, I mean, I can stop there. And then I was talking with Jeff earlier, just really quick. I had initially did a nice summary highlights. I don't know if Jeff said, I think that you did pass that out, but I'm happy to sort of go over that again. But if you guys have already gone over it, I don't want to be duplicative.
Can I use that as a reference?
Oh, absolutely.
I was personally not present at that. I'd be glad. We have a could have a maybe a quick review of this. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
She could sense it. Can I ask you one question before you leave? And if either one of you can answer, it'd be great. When you were referencing a number of attorneys that were responsible for contract drafting, regardless of whether or not it's simple or more complicated, has OGC ever thought about using lay people to help with the contract load in terms of drafting? Because I know a lot of governmental agencies and private sector companies don't always use attorneys to handle contract drafting, particularly depending on what size the contract may be.
So that is a really great question. So just random lay people, no. I don't think that. But, however, we have legal assistants and paralegals. So that's the other thing I want to tell you. Because this is so much of this is form-driven, we purposefully, for the client's sake, we push as much of form-driven drafting down to the people that don't charge hourly rates. And that's going to be your legal assistants. And I have one senior paralegal in my shop. And part of the training that we do with the staff in government operations is to train these folks on, how to populate business points. Because that's all there. And I think one of your commissioners mentioned that at the one meeting. That's all you're doing at that point, really. It makes no sense for me to spend my time. I think we're billing out close to $200 an hour, probably on down to the lowest attorney at $140. To literally insert the name of an entity. So there's a lot of just, checks, entity names. We're contract lawyers, so we need to make sure that it's precise, exactly. The name that's on some biz is the name that's actually on the contract. So a lot of the attorneys don't do any of that. We push that work down to our legal assistants and our paralegals.
No, and I just came from private practice. It's the same practice that we're following here. It's to be as efficient as possible. But it is a great question. But at some point, we want attorneys' eyes to make sure that we. Okay. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Okay. So we have the summary in front of us. So one thing I want to just kind of remind this committee of, and I took the time to remind the council of this when I did my first presentation to the council. Back in, 1968, when we were consolidating as a government, I will read you just a few quotes that I think are just critical to, understanding at a high level just how important this procurement bill is. So back in 1968, one of my favorite books, A Quiet Revolution, written by Richard Martin, which tells the story about our consolidated government. Here's a few quotes. So at the heart of the philosophy behind all the moving and merging and restructuring was central services, a concept which reflected consolidation's fundamental purpose, to hold down the cost of government while making it more efficient and economical. Central services introduced the management techniques and higher operational standards. Mayor Hans Tansler referred to central services as the heart and soul of consolidated government. The central services department head regarded central services as the brain center of the new government and the heart of consolidated government. And my last quote is that it would be through central services that many of consolidation's promised economic and greater efficiencies would be achieved, for example, in standardized professional bidding, purchasing, and insurance procedures. So, you know, when I was doing this presentation to the city council, I said the central services are to the consolidated government what the heart is to the body. And so back in 1968, what were our central services departments? We had a motor pool, that's our fleet, personnel services, communications, legal, Office of General Counsel, public relations, and procurement division was one of our central services departments. So, you know, when we talk about trying to achieve those efficiencies in consolidated government, it is right here with what we're doing in procurement. I mean, when we talk about those efficiencies and how do we not only efficient for the city of Jacksonville, but also efficient for the people that's doing business with us, so that we get more bidders, and more bidders will get better prices and better quality bidders in the case of when you're talking about evaluated bids. So one of the main things, and I'm to my summary here, Roman number one, a large part of this bill was restructuring the committees. So currently we have three procurement committees that are made up of ex officio positions in the city. So on one of our committees, you know, you would have had the finance director, procurement chief, and Office of General Counsel. Office of General Counsel and the three current committees you'll see here in this B that exists is our GJAC, our General Government Awards Committee, our PSEC, Professional Services Evaluation Committee, and then our CSPEC, our Competitive Seal Proposal Evaluation Committee. And all of these committees, OGC is sitting on the committees, which is not a good idea because we're the lawyers. And we need to be able to give advice to committees the same way I'm doing to you right now, as opposed to being an officer of a committee that now I can't even talk to the committee members. And so one of the great changes in this bill was to place OGC and the procurement chief, quite frankly, in their proper roles. As, you know, think of the procurement chief as the CEO of the procurement division. That's who's teeing everything up for the committees and making recommendations. And OGC is, of course, advising not only the committees, but we're advising the procurement chief. So that was one change. We took those three committees and we combined them into one. And so we think, you know, that's going to achieve greater efficiencies. We wrote language in the code. Right now, the committees meet once a week. But it's three committees meeting on the same day. By having the one committee, we purposefully wrote language to encourage the procurement chief and the committees to meet as often as possible to keep up with the needs of the agencies. Because at one point in time, when I got here in 2007, procurement committees were meeting twice a week. So this bill kind of contemplates that procurement, you're here to serve these agencies to make sure that these operational kind of procurement needs are met. So one of the powers that we took away, and this is now, so C is talking about the compensation of the composition of this one committee. So the one committee will consist of the finance director, risk manager, and our public works director. Public works is such a large agency when it comes to procurement, so they've always sat on many of these committees. And then in D, we revised the scope of this committee, and we did that because we're hoping that's going to create efficiencies on the time that it takes to develop. So what I didn't talk about today was how long it takes to develop the RFP and the solicitation. That's what you heard from Dustin. But one of the things we're hoping that will help is taking out of the purview of the procurement committees the ability to approve the solicitation document. And that's standard. So right now, if you are an agency, and this only applies to professional services, but if you wanted to put out a bid for some, whatever you name it, contractual professional service, you'd have to go to procurement first to just have that solicitation document approved. And in 99.9% of the cases, I probably say 100% of the cases, the procurement committees are just, approving whatever's put before them. Well, with all of our other independent agencies like JEA, JTA, JPA, et cetera, That's not standard. And so we're taking that out of the procurement committee's purview, which makes for a quicker procurement time, because now we're not interjecting the one step of having to, before we can put that document out on the street, having to bring it before the committee to have the committee approve. And the other rationale behind that is that solicitation document is really the technical specifications that all you need are really two groups to look at that. The agency itself, that's the expert over those technical specifications, and the procurement analyst that's going to pretty it up, if you will, so that we can put it out on the street in a marketable way and get as many bids as we need to come back in. So E here is just sort of a listing of those duties. So the primary duties of approving the awards, terminating the contract awards, you know, making those awards will all remain. The duty of amending the procurement operating manual. So right now, just, you know, kind of, and this will bring us into the second Roman numeral, we already have a procurement operating manual. What we primarily did in this rewrite is we took a lot of the process detail that's in our code, and we removed all of that detail, and we just put the broad framework. So instead of talking about, if I do an invitation to bid, it's word by word, you have 10 days, then you can modify. Instead of listing those steps out, we took a step back and just said, well, why are we talking about the process? Let's stay up here at 100,000-foot level, and let's just talk about what methods are the council okay with allowing the city to do. And so, like, right now, by code, the only methods we can really do is the invitation to bid and the request for proposal. Like, the invitation to negotiate, I don't know if you guys are familiar with that.
But
yes, of course, yes. How would you be familiar?
I just have to say, for the record, JEA gave ITNs such a bad name. Any other place, they're the most useful because you can actually negotiate with the vendor. Anyway, sorry.
Well, point well taken. And so the idea here was, why are we limiting ourselves? Whatever procurement tool out there is available by state statute that's commonly used, if it's good enough, and by the way, you know, Board Member Henry, the state uses it all the time, and they've been using it. They were actually the entity that invented it because of the constraints that we had with the request for proposal. So, you know, the concept and the idea in this rewrite bill was to, let's just broaden the city's procurement toolbox as much as we can, and we'll leave it up to the procurement chief and the agency to determine which tool in the toolbox makes best sense for the agency to be able to use. Okay. So, let's see. So we also obviously did some cleanup in the procurement bill. There were some sections that were obsolete. The last time the procurement code had been really looked at hard was probably over 30 years. So what you have in D is really more of the cleanup that we did. There were places in the code, for example, where we had arts and public places stuck in Chapter 126. That's our current procurement code. We literally removed that whole entire part and put it in the place where it made sense, where we had other cultural council kind of programs. I'll move down to Roman numeral 3. We have increased the authority of the procurement chief, because essentially, by removing the detail out of the code and sticking with more of a framework, then that means that detail is now placed in that procurement operating manual that the procurement chief is controlling with the approval of the board and the mayor. So we have added some layers of approval there. So it's not just the chief that's able to amend it. The chief can recommend, but those recommendations would ultimately have to go before the board, and then the mayor would have to sign off. So we increased our informal thresholds. We currently had an informal threshold. This is now Roman numeral 3B that was $65,000. I mean, we have a $1.4 million budget here at the city. And billion. Did I say? I thought I said billion. Okay, billion. Billion-dollar budget. So, point. billion-dollar budget, $65,000 level for informal just doesn't make sense. And this number didn't come out of anywhere. I think Dustin mentioned that it was on par with other comparable cities. There might have been one other city that had a limit that was $200,000. So the auditors felt like, you know, that was a fair change to increase that. So really the main increase in authority here is there are many places in this bill where the procurement chief has the ability to promulgate those rules as long as they are consistent with state statutes. So the safety net here is, yes, we have expanded our procurement toolbox, but we've only expanded it to the point of allowing our procurement chief to go in and come up with rules that do not conflict with state law. So now moving on to four, some of this was moving things around so that it was more reader friendly. If you were to go look at our current code, I'd be very surprised if you can manage to get through it without either falling asleep, being very confused or frustrated, because it's just not an easy code to read. And we would expect that because it's over 30 years old. Going to the second page, we have added some new exemptions. So the exemptions in procurement are things where you do not have to take it out to bid. So we already right now have a listing in our procurement code where we allow this using agency to directly contract if it fits within one of the exemptions. One of the exemptions, for example, is whenever another governmental entity is providing services to the city, we don't compete that because that just makes sense. Like if, you know, two governmental entities, you know, governmental entity providing services, we're going to trust that, you know, that's a governmental entity and that's just, you know, makes good efficiency sense for the city. So we've added a few tools here, the pilot projects, collaborative agreements, joint projects. These are actually all exemptions that are sister agencies, JEA. In fact, when we were coming up with these, a lot of the research that we had done was looking at what did our sister agencies already have in their code. So item six, this is our transparency section of the bill. So we were trying to address ethics issues from a city employee standpoint, from a vendor standpoint, and so we have some provisions there. You'll see and see, you know, we want to hear from the people that we're doing business from, and I think Dustin did mention that when he was here, that there is a requirement that every 3 years we have a survey and that the procurement chief take that information and consider it in the amendments that can be put forth to the procurement operating manual. If y'all have questions, you know, let me know. I'm trying to keep this like very high level because I can talk hours about procurement if y'all like. So going to seven, Dustin spoke about this new contract administration oversight provisions. The only thing I'll say coming off of listening to the presentation that Dustin gave is, you know, we have agencies that have really good contract administrators. And so what I want to point out is, you know, I consider the Office of General Counsel to have such a unique vantage point in this government because, you know, our procurement chief, you know, they touch upon some of the agencies, but it's a limited touching that they do because it's only it's only related to the development of a solicitation document. Whereas Office of General Counsel, we are representing all of these agencies in every capacity, their day-to-day operations that they do. So I think we have a unique sort of vantage point. And I can tell you, I can name endless clients, whether it's Kids Hope Alliance, whether it's Public Works, Housing, where they do have contract administrators. They have people that are absolutely monitoring deliverables that are in contract. So I don't want y'all to think that in this entire government, contracts are being executed and using agencies are not properly administering those contracts. I see it, you know, I deal with it. Do we have problem contracts? Absolutely. $1.4 billion budget. Of course we have problem contracts, but on the whole, I just want you to know in my relationships with these agencies, I think they're doing a pretty good job from what I can tell, at least. So I wanted to make that point. But what this concept is really about is we do now add an additional responsibility to the procurement to train people on contract administration. Again, some of our agencies are already doing this. For Kids Hope Alliance, code section actually requires them to have contract administrators.
But
No, you're fine. I mean, I really would prefer this to be more of a dialogue as
okay,
I'm going
all right,
through.
So this is one of my biggest items in my mind in terms of the change. Outside of Kids Hope Alliance, that's the only reference in the code. Whatever system they wanted to use. Which, in some cases, allows laboratories of experimentation. In other cases, it. So the language is as adopted, really leaves it to the procurement chief to develop this program with other individuals involved. But it has that caveat language that anyone's paying attention always knows what it means. If you government a lot, it says subject to something to that nature. So it's really incumbent on council and the administration to really give the procurement that, because he made it very clear at our last meeting that he doesn't have the resources really right now to accomplish what he would want to envision.
Right, correct. So I think this is two, I mean, I kind of see this really as kind of three contract administration components that was contemplated in the bill. So one component is the B that talks about at contract administration requirement for certain high-risk contracts via a contract administrator. So the rewrite provision requires that the procurement chief working with the inspector general will develop sort of a high, what are the high risk contracts? And in having those conversations with our inspector general, really he's talking about, for example, some contracts that hit a certain threshold. If it's over $20 million, probably be a lower threshold than that. Contracts that are single source. The single source method is when you just directly contract with somebody because you justifiably believe they're the only source that can provide the service. So that's a requirement in the bill. And when those high-risk contracts are defined by the inspector general working with, I think it's the chief administrative officer, the using agencies are required to designate a contract administrator to administer those contracts. So I think that's a positive in the sense of right now there could be no one at all on these high-risk contracts that are paying attention. There could be, could not be. But this requires for sure, at least on the high risk, that immediately those using agencies make sure that there's somebody that's on point with respect to the administration of those contracts. So that's one piece. The other contract administration element is the annual training. So that annual training, our past chief procurement, Greg Peace, as some of you may recall and remember, I know Mr. Zabuni does for sure, that's already a PowerPoint. I've seen that. I mean, so that doesn't cost anything. That's literally bringing all of your using agency folks in as designated by the directors to sit in on annual training to understand, A, this procurement methods, high points of deliverables to contracts, you know, when does the contract expire, insurance certificates. I mean, that, to me, and this is only from my vantage point, so I'm not a director of a department or a chief of the department in the procurement chief's case, but I think the code language was only contemplating there more of a PowerPoint, a training, two-hour workshop. I've done that myself, Office of General Counsel, working with the administration. The piece that I think Dustin was talking about was the certification contract administrator. So there's a component of this where you take some classes. Or,
I read them as the same thing. So you're saying
There is a distinction. Yes, there's a distinction. So there's So if you look at D, requires annual contract administrator training by the chief and consultation with the inspector general and city ethics officer to include ethics in public contracting, contract administration and oversight, procurement methods and procedures, contract risk assessment program. That to me is not the same thing as E, which is adds additional chief of procurement responsibilities in section 24603 related to the contract administrator training and certification is the key. That's what I think Dustin's talking about. Like people to go in and train enough, however many courses that's going to be, so that you are certified. As I understand, that's where I think maybe additional staff would be required. But to work with my office, Kirby Oberdorfer, and the Matt LaSalle to come up with the PowerPoint and train, I think we can accomplish that. And I can tell you that's what the intent was when I drafted it.
I would highly, and I said this to highly recommend, if you're looking for examples, the state does this as their bread and butter with DMS. Yeah. There's
very good.
Every state agency or state-related entity that has a contract administrator or manager has to have someone certified. They have to take that one day or a couple hour training every 3 years, and they're qualified to be able to administer a contract that's worth more than $100,000.
So
there's already programs out there where the city really just can just copy and paste. Yes.
We are all in favor of plagiarism to some extent. We are not shy about that. And, best models, best practices. And I noted that as a comment when I was taking notes and refreshing myself on the tapes preparing for this. So, no, very well taken and great comment. And then so 8 is really just the electronic procurement system. I may have skipped over it a bit also in the first bullet, but there's a lot of language in this bill that is enabling us to have electronic signatures, DocuSign, online bids. Not everything can be online bids. There's some statutory limitations there, but as much of this that can be moved to an electronic format, that is totally the direction that this bill is trying to set up the framework in order for us to do that. Now, again, things cost money, but from my legal perspective, this was more about what language do I need to have in the code to enable this administration or the next to be able to actually implement an electronic system.
Can I give a theoretical question?
Yeah.
So city council, through a single source, I think it's like $30,000 or $40,000, I think the company's called Gravis. In order for them,
Granicus. Yes, yes.
And that's the standard for most government entities, anyway. In order for them to broadcast all their meetings, to provide all their documents to the public simultaneously, so it makes it really easy. Now, I'm not on council side, so I don't know how difficult it is to run the system.
Right.
But it makes it really easy for the public to be able to kind of view meetings as they're occurring, get the recordings after they've occurred, and then look at the documents thereafter. Right now, procurement is using Zoom, and when I was asking Mr. Freeman, as nice as I could, about how to make those type of recordings and documents more available, he just said, in essence, someone can put a public records request, and anyone that's placed a public records request with the city knows it's not fast. So since the city council's already done a single source for this vendor, it's a standard vendor that a lot of government agencies use. Why can't procurement or other boards and commissions that are not run by council use that same single source of those licenses to be able to perform that same function?
Yeah, so I think in theory, absolutely, that's totally possible to take a look at that city council contract and see how that scope can be expanded, particularly if you know, I don't know this would be the case, but, you know.
From what I read, the licenses are almost.
Yeah, single source. That was one of the notes that I wrote here. So part of this bill was in that, and there is a section called Ethics and Public Transparency and Contracting. totally moving in that direction of, as you said, the state is a great example. You could easily go on the website, get access to contracts, get access to bid documents, and I firmly believe it's really cheaper on the city because, as you indicated, the public records expense of not only for the public but the city and the time and resources that it takes to have to pull together records and all of that. So I think there's probably some economic efficiencies that can be achieved. But this bill is there's a section in the bill, transparency in public contracting, that talks about the access that the city has, of course, to the vendors' records, but also the access that the public has to the city's records. And, you know, as far as meetings being online, that is just an executive branch call to make. Probably not Dustin's call, but yeah. But you know what I mean?
I mean only in the sense of if that single source exists, because it does, are other city agencies able to?
Probably with an amendment to that contract document and an increase in the maximum indebtedness amount, yes. So it's really just an executive, you know, call to be made. And I can tell you, at least with some of the discussions I've had with Dr. Ahmad, who is the diversity, equity, inclusion, I know for a fact that part of what he's been looking at is the accessibility of the public by tools such as Zoom or Teams, because not everybody can drive down to City Hall and attend this meeting. Maybe that's why nobody's here. Attend this meeting or other meetings. And so, but trying to look at how do we tap into the public's access to records and access to board meetings, I know that that's something that's on his agenda to explore. So the very last paragraph really just talks about the prospectiveness of this bill. The bill will be implemented July 1st, 2024 is by law when this bill is online and ready to go and be operative. And between that time, the procurement chief has a certain amount of time. And in fact, these dates are outdated as I'm looking at it. So we had to update these dates. I think Dustin may have shared that this bill was sitting in abeyance. It was actually filed in January of this year, originally by Councilwoman Cumber. It was sitting in abeyance all the way through August. I began doing my presentations. It was working its way through committees, and it was recently passed in September. So we updated these dates. So actually the go-live date of the new code provisions is July 1st of 2024, and the procurement chief has to produce this document by June 1st of 2024 to give a 30-day interval for the inspector general and the auditor's office to be able to provide comments. So, and then we also have in the bill a proactive directive where the chief is required to inform the using agencies and begin training the agencies on what's in the code. Because, Tony, you and I have had offline conversations that, you know, you don't do an overwrite this large and not give the very clients in the city that's dealing with procurement on a day-in, day-out basis the heads up or the understanding of what's in this new bill. So a lot of time is going to be spent actually meeting with the agencies. What format that's done in, don't know. That'll be up to Dustin. But I'll certainly be there front and center to make sure that, you know, agencies are being trained and given the right information. So that's all I have. Any questions?
I have two, and then I have one for Tom. The two questions I had, with ITNs being a new form of ITNs being a new form of procurement method that they can use contract with vendors or to try to seek to contract with vendors, how does that kind of change the dynamic since now you can negotiate? And as you said earlier, the attorneys weren't really tasked to do that. It was really incumbent on the agency. Are you going to be, how is that going to work?
Well, so I think there's a legal aspect to that that we've got to make sure is implemented pursuant to statute. So the beauty of the ITN, as you said, is that ability to have frank discussions with each bidder separately so that the agency can get the product that brings the best value. And
and price.
Correct. And best value, I think, is what the statute says. But certainly you would take price into consideration. And I think from a legal perspective, really, it's just making sure when the procurement operating manual is addressing how to implement that particular procurement method, that we address and we have tight controls on, we can't, you know, making sure that the meetings are confidential, making sure that the statute's being followed. So you can have a meeting outside of the sunshine, but there's certain dictates that you've got to do in order for that non-sunshine meeting to be legal. Like, you've got to have a tape recorder in that meeting so that you can record those proceedings. And certainly if a bidder wants to protest, you know, they would have access to those tapes and, you know, so on and so forth. So there's a certain legal aspect to the ITN. The good news is we have other agencies in the city that, as you pointed out, that's been using that procurement method already. And we haven't experienced a lot of bid protests based on those procurement methods. We have had bid protests, but from my vantage point, because the Office of General Counsel would be representing those outside the independent agencies as well, it's certainly, it's not like every time they use that method, there are 20 different protests that Office of General Counsel is having to, you know, grapple with. So to me, it's a matter of making sure that the operating manual is as detailed as possible to make sure that we're keeping the agency out of trouble and compliant with the law. Otherwise, that negotiation piece, I still don't anticipate that the lawyer's going to be in those negotiation sessions. Again, the clients would still be doing that negotiations because they really are the experts. You don't want to put me in there negotiating design build because I don't have any engineering skill set. But what our office does and what we've always done is the standard boilerplate, the sovereign immunity issues, the indemnification, working with risk management, the city's rights to terminate, to suspend the work. That's the kind of boilerplate stuff that you're always going to need OGC to do and we kind of control. But the technicality, that's really going to lie in the bosom, if you will, of the agency every time.
That definitely helps. And then the last question I had for you, is outside, I know KHA and council direct contracts are exempt from the procurement code. With this rewrite, are there any other contract types that are exempt?
So the council direct contracts are actually acting consistent with the procurement code because you're right, there is an exemption for enabling legislation. But Kids Hope Alliance, pursuant to Chapter 77 of our code.
I should have said exemption.
That they're required to compete a good amount of their services, but they also can use the exemptions that are in the code. Is that so are you asking, are any other agencies? So, yeah, it just depends
or
on.
Yeah,
it depends on the type of service. So, for example, Downtown Investment Authority, you know, their world lies in Chapter 55 of our code. And so to the extent that they're dealing with professional services, they would absolutely also have to use the procurement code. To the extent they're dealing with a redevelopment agreement, something that is outside of procurement, then they would be following the rules of their bid plan document, a document that was authorized by City Council, that depending on what's in those redevelopment agreements may or may not necessitate further council action. But your pure traditional acquisition of supplies, services, contractual services, construction, for example, architectural engineering, doesn't matter where you sit in the city, you're subject to Chapter 126. I don't know of any agency. On the whole, because, you know, we're pretty big. But, so there are some that can be exempt, but that would be very specific to a particular code section that allows for that exemption for a very council-determined needed reason. But on the whole, I'm talking generalities here, all of the city would be subject to Chapter 126.
Including all the constitutional officers?
Including the constitutional officers, because those offices are part of COJ. The only entities that are not a part of COJ would be our independent agencies, which are separately distinct body politic and corporates. Everybody else, because people think the Downtown Investment Authority is a separate, no, they're not. They're a part of COJ. The city council has simply delegated authority to that particular entity, just like the CEO of Kids Hope Alliance, to be able to sign contracts on the city's behalf. They're always, all of these boards and commissions of the cities, you know, they're always signing and acting on the city's behalf because we're all part of COJ as an entity. If that makes sense. Okay. All right.
Any more questions?
Okay. Yeah.
I want to thank you so much for coming. That was
you're welcome.
A lot of information. My hat's off to you.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, just don't let them tell you it's stuck in OGC, okay?
I knew
don't
someone
let them
was
tell
gonna
you that.
Come and say that. I knew that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for entertaining me for so long.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Approval of the minutes. I know there's at least one change on the minutes. Would we concur that the meeting did not adjourn at 5:11? Probably more like 5:59. I don't know the exact time, but it was close to 6 o'clock. Okay. With that, are there any more changes or updates to the minutes? Is there a motion to accept the minutes as amended?
So moved.
Second.
There's been a motion moved and second to accept the minutes. If there's no opposition, the minutes will stand as amended. Auditor's report. You got any auditors or any audits for us?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, to the commission, the council auditor's office had released 2 reports since the last true commission meeting. However, I will be presenting 4 reports today because 2 of the reports from last month had not been presented to the Finance Committee prior to the November True Commission meeting. Report number 800B is a follow-up on the wires transfer audit. City wires transfer audit was released on November 7th. This was the second follow-up, and one item was cleared. There were 3 outstanding. One item was cleared, and there's still 2 outstanding. The 2 remaining issues, as accounting was approving the wire transfers only after Treasury had sent the wire out, and that was on 16 of 19 invoices. And then the other one was we actually wrapped the 2 into 1. Wire transaction procedures were inconsistent with the municipal code. And so those 2 internal weaknesses, or one was an internal weakness, one's finding, will be followed up on in the future.
Wasn't there an audit with the, maybe what you're talking about, with the retirement fund?
That's coming up.
Oh, that's coming up. I have it here. I'm looking for it.
Yeah, it was the defined contribution audit. That's coming up. So with that one, there were 9 original issues on this report, and there are now 2 left to be followed up on. Internal control weakness 1, which is the wire requests were not initiated in the accounting system. And then the wire transaction procedures were inconsistent with the municipal code. And
are we looking at 815B?
800B.
800B, okay.
00B. Next one is report number 856A. And this is the electronic funds transfer in audit. This was released on November 7th of 2023. This was the first follow-up on this audit. This audit was done because, and you may remember this, there was approximately about $8 million of CARES funding that was not recognized in the system about 2 weeks that the city had received. You remember?
Yeah, I remember that one.
That kind of touched off an audit. So, so with this one, there were six issues originally in the audit. Four issues were cleared, so there's two remaining. The two issues still open are wires in are still not recorded in a timely manner. 40% of the wires in are not recorded within 15 days. And so this, they're still refining the procedures to ensure this is timely and also to try to direct as many receipts to the tax collector as for deposit.
Is it because they're not reconciled, or what do you mean by they're not reflected within 15 days?
It's not recorded into one cloud, into the financial system. Within 15 days.
So is the, not to get technical, but when auditors, when Treasury is reconciling cash flow from whatever bank accounts or special accounts that the city has, weren't recognizing the wires that they were receiving as income?
They weren't being recorded. Of the deposits, we tested 643 deposits. 392 of them, 61%, were recorded in the city's financial system over 15 days from the date the payments were deposited in the bank. So they were showing in the bank, being deposited in the bank, but they weren't showing up in the city's, on the city's financial system for over 15 days. So it's you know, it's a reconciliation in a timely manner, timely issue as well, because you know, you want to be able to see that funds have come into the city, because you know, someone looks at one cloud and is expecting to see a deposit. May be in the bank, but the OneCloud user doesn't have access to the bank statement. And the other, you'll love this one. The other one is termination of access rights and in the ERP system. There were 315 user accounts belonging to terminated employees or contractors. ITD says there was no default access is granted. They terminate the default access. What we recommend is also we're recommending they continue work with using departments to confirm access on a individual basis. We're saying that even if disabled from the active directory, if an employee returns, they might be granted unauthorized access. Might be granted. So we're saying they need to do a little bit further on disabling the active on the directory. So that was report number 856A follow up.
Wait.
Yep.
There is a line. There's that last line in ITD that says, in addition, ITD will consult with Oracle and other municipalities using Oracle Fusion Cloud ERP to benchmark best practices for account security and implement those. What happened to that lovely report that we were promised that they were going to do to evaluate all the systems that they are unaware of, so that way they can have an inventory of them and then help manage the account issues?
I'm not sure that ITD ever got back with the True Commission.
Well, they did. I think Jeff said that they did it with one division in Finance Administration, and then that was it. Or it was it HR? Yeah, and I think it was like there's so many systems it took longer than we thought. And then
so I don't know what. I told you guys. All right. Report number 815B is the follow-up on the defined contribution audit. This report was released on November 15th of 2023. This is the second follow-up audit. In the original audit, there were 16 items, 16 issues. the first follow-up cleared 14 of the 16. There were two remaining. Then this report cleared one of the two. The one report was a supplemental internal control weakness that the pension office employees were not following the city's cash receipt standard operating procedures. And we recommended that the pension office, that was in the first, when this follow-up, we found reconciliations were still not being performed. They're not following all the city's cash receipt procedures. Not following all the city's cash receipts procedures could lead to various issues such as misappropriation of funds. They agreed with the position. They agreed that the pension office has not been complying with step 26 of 27, which they verify all the deposits due from the previous month and are complete by verifying entry within OneCloud.
So does this solution that they provided, does that reflect, let me rephrase that, does that achieve the reconciliation portion that you guys spoke about?
It'll be able to break out the detail. They were saying that the difficulty has been in the individual checks are batched together when they're deposited into OneCloud. It makes it difficult to see the individual checks. And so they're working with the tax collector to get a more detailed report. Comes in one cloud, you just see.
But when was the first audit done?
The first original audit was done November. The report was released in September of 2018.
That was before OneCloud.
Well, yes.
So if reconciliation was an issue prior to OneCloud and they weren't doing reconciliation since OneCloud, that's why I was curious if this solution that they're describing will achieve the reconciliation.
This was a supplemental issue.
It doesn't read that way, but I don't know whether or not I was misunderstanding.
Right. I'm not sure on that. Well, of course, now they're in OneCloud. The first follow-up was in January of 2020, which when we followed up would have been in OneCloud. So, yes, they weren't doing it. They had issues with OneCloud it being all in one batch. So now, hopefully they're working with the tax collector so they can see a more detailed report. And final one that I have is report number 834A. It's the follow-up on the tax collector audit. 2019 local business tax was released on November 15th of 2023. This was the first follow up on this report. The original audit was released in June 11 of 2020, which is coming in out of the COVID stuff. And anyway, there were 12 items on the original report, and all 12-ish items were cleared. So this report, all the issues have been cleared, and we consider this audit. That concludes my report.
And this is the one I was saving for you.
Okay.
So Ms. Lakeisha said that in addition to the IG, she'd be working with the council auditor on the procurement manual on the final product. And I was curious, there is some outstanding issues that are left from report 870, 871 that deal with contracts on procurement audits that you did. And a lot of those controls that were placed in there, the solutions that were said by Mr. Freeman at the time was that they were going to be updating the procurement manual. So this is not a question I know you can answer, but is the council auditor going to be infusing some of those issues that were outstanding in 871 and 870 when she's having discussions with the procurement division chief on how the procurement manual will find it? Because it sounds like it's a place for them to
right.
Stuff.
Not not speaking for the council auditor, but I'm sure that the weaknesses that we've seen will come up. Procurement code, right? You will address those first time. We can advise and give concerns. The final approval comes from but we'll definitely yes give our on and a lot comes into what we've seen in the audits and things like
that. Okay, cool. I just want to make sure that it wasn't one of those where the next time there's a follow-up That's the next time someone actually reads through the controls and you work through the manual and you're like, oh wait, we had these issues that we had addressed.
Well, at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Commissioner Roundsville. I have to go, but and I'll bring it up in January. I was going to ask the chairman if she would put members on the onboarding committee that we have. I'll bring that up to her in January since she wasn't here tonight. I would also recommend that we maybe put off your proposal one more month since half the people aren't here tonight. But I want to wish each and every one of you guys a happy holidays, Merry Christmas, or anything else. Be safe out there. There's going to be some crazy people on the streets. And have a good time.
Same to you.
And hopefully, maybe I'll see you guys before the new year at city council meeting or something.
Yeah,
but you guys have a wonderful holiday.
You too.
You do the same. Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Next on the agenda, the committee reports. Audit Committee, Legislative Tracking Committee. I don't think we have any reports on those. Okay. Chair's comments. Well, we heard from the Vice Chair, so that's taken care of. Any old business? We have the bylaws revision.
I move we defer this item on the agenda until January.
All in favor?
Aye.
Move that to January. Next is new business. Is there any new business we need to discuss, Jeff?
Are there any new appointees that are on the horizon?
I have one person who's been trying to get appointed by the mayor, and I don't know what they're doing, but they're not appointing people to this commission, so.
There were a lot of other appointments that I was looking for one for this one as well and didn't see anything. Well, maybe.
He recommended someone as well?
Maybe next month. No other new business? Commissioner comments? Daniel? Mr. Henry?
I think it's after we have our conversation with Mr. Freeman, I think we need to get in the posture of making, if there are any recommendations based on some of the conversations that we had now with Procurement, Public Works, OGC, and ITD in terms of efficiencies that we can see in the process. I know the rewrite is going to cover a lot of the concerns that we kind of talked about almost a year ago or 6 months ago, but there's still little idiosyncrasies that I would love to make sure that they are incorporated in whatever the manual looks like before it's a final product. And you could probably tell based on my questioning in some of the meetings, the public information portion of it is probably like my biggest concern. Because sometimes, and I know it's not their intent, but sometimes I get the impression that that's kind of a low on the totem pole issue. But for the people we have conversations with and the people that we serve, and frankly from the news stories that we always get and see, it's probably the one thing that always seems to kind of blow up in the city's face. So I think it's important for us to make sure that we make that clear to council and to the mayor's office, particularly when they start developing next year's fiscal budget, that they actually give resources so that way those type of issues are addressed. So we address some of Mr. Freeman's concerns about not having the resources to be able to. Yeah, and I think it's time, because a lot of government agencies already do this. I think this is something that the city has to come to terms with or to start to think of. There really should be a formalized vendor management process. That's just, it's SOP standard in the private sector. It's standard sometimes for governmental agencies, and it helps kind of bridge the gap between what agencies are responsible for, what procurement's responsible for, and then what happens after the contract is fully developed and executed. Because we've sat through enough of these meetings where I've gotten the impression that once the contract is done, it seems like everyone's job is done and no one's kind of paying attention to, okay, how are you scoring this vendor? How are they performing? Do you want to continue using them? I think the IG audit that Jeff sent last week was a perfect example of that, where, if you haven't read it, it's a fleet management audit where you had JSO officers that were complaining between themselves about the service that they were getting from the vendor that they use in order for them to service their cars, and fleet management was completely clueless that they had those concerns. But you can't fault them because it didn't seem from his audit that there was a true process for them to be able to kind of express those concerns. So if you're a contract administrator in fleet management, how are you really scoring this vendor if you're not getting or seem to understand the viewpoints that some of your customers are experiencing?
No comments.
Brownsville, no comments.
Move we adjourn.
Is there a second? Meeting adjourned at 5:27. Thank you all. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays. However you celebrate.